Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The man who shot and killed a Clark County sheriff's deputy a week and a half ago was not new to the criminal justice system. He had been found incompetent to stand trial in 2001 when he shot and injured another sheriff's deputy in Malta, Ohio. He was found mentally incompetent to stand trial and admitted for 2 years to a maximum security psychiatric facility here in Columbus to restore his competency so he could stand trial. But he was discharged back into the court system in 2003 and found not guilty by reason of insanity. For the next 2 years, he was treated in a Morgan County mental health facility and then released with conditions. Today, we're here to talk about how the system is supposed to work. We can't talk about that case. It's in adjudication now, and we're not going to talk about that. But in general, how are mentally ill defendants treated for their illnesses? How are they released back into society? And what's the goal and what's the reality? Coming up later, we're going to meet a local judge who has heard hundreds of cases, many involving defendants who are mentally ill. We'll also hear from the medical director of the Adam H. Board of Franklin County, herself a recognized expert in how mental health care is delivered in our prisons and jails. Joining us now is John Murphy. He's longtime executive director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. John helped write the law on how the courts manage mentally ill defendants who are found to be incompetent to stand trial and or not guilty by reason of insanity in Ohio. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you.
Also with us is James Tyack. He's a partner in the law firm of Tyack, Blackmore, Liston, and Nye. James has represented criminal defendants at all levels of the criminal justice system, including many deemed mentally ill. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you, man.
John, let's start just kind of with a little bit of a history lesson and talk about how the laws have changed over the years to address the issue of mental illness in the criminal justice system in Ohio. The big turning point in modern times is said to be the case of John Hinckley, the man who attempted to assassinate President Reagan, but it goes back farther.
Oh, yes. We've been struggling with this issue for some years, as a matter of fact. It goes back even farther to, or I'm not sure whether it's farther or not, but anyway, you remember the Twinkie case in California where somebody made a claim that they were not responsible because they ate too many Twinkies and it affected their mental.
I don't remember that.
No, that was famous. No. Anyway, about that time is when Ohio got rid of the irresistible impulse insanity defense, which was, we felt, abused a lot, and I think the legislature agreed with us, which is why they repealed the irresistible impulse factor. Another major change was to give the local criminal court judge the authority to deal with insanity cases even after they found not guilty by reason of insanity, which was a big change because the criminal court judge who heard the case knows the case best. Before then, we would send these people to hospitals, and the probate judge at the local hospital jurisdiction would deal with these cases, and we felt he was not as tuned in to the local community concerns as the local criminal court judge would be. So the law was changed in that respect as well. Later on, in 1997, I think it actually was, we tightened up the law even further on how these people are dealt with, relying on the local judge, giving him a little more power, putting some more teeth into the law, we felt, requiring second opinions, for example, from the mental health professionals before these people could be released, other changes. So there has been a gradual evolving of the law, toughening of the law, we think, and I'm not sure how much further we can go, but we're always going to have people fall through the cracks, but I think we have pretty good law in this state right now.
Of course, mental illness is along a continuum, so someone might not reach that threshold of guilty by reason of insanity, but they may still be deemed mentally ill.
Oh, there are a lot of people who are mentally ill, especially in the criminal courts. I think that's well known. Many people engaging in criminal activity are, you know, they have mental problems. A lot of them have drug problems also. But as you say, there are very few who actually get to the point of even claiming to be not guilty by reason of insanity. Very few trials that are contested on not guilty by reason of insanity. Sometimes the prosecutor will agree that the guy is insane and that will not be contested. So you get some cases like that. But actually, it happens very rarely.
What in the law is put forth to on how people who are deemed not guilty by reason of insanity, how are they handled after that?
Well, they're if the verdict comes back not guilty by reason of insanity, the defendant has to be examined by the mental health professionals to see if he currently is still mentally ill and a danger to himself and others, is what it boils down to. If he is found to be mentally ill and a danger to himself or others, he can be committed by the judge. Again, the criminal court judge keeps jurisdiction of this guy, which is very important. And then he goes to a facility to be treated and attempt to restore him to reason and to get him back to a normal life, if possible. There are periodic reports back to the court about the guy's progress. If the mental health professionals feel that he's recovered, they can ask the court to consider putting him on transitional control or conditional release, or even finally a full release if he does get restored to a normal life.
You're listening to John Murphy. He's executive director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. Also with us, James Tyak, criminal defense attorney. James, we've made the point that it's very rare that somebody is found not guilty by reason of insanity. Is that because it's hard to prove it, or is it because it's rarely sought?
It's probably a combination of both, really. I think the defense side, and sometimes, as Mr. Murphy said, in conjunction with the prosecution's cooperation, you evaluate your clients coming in the door. And usually somebody who's going to qualify for this type of assessment, and it relates to competency and ability to stand trial as well, a lot of times they're going to have a history of mental health treatment. And a lot of times parents are involved, or AAMH and others. So you know that going in. Many times, though, as you look into that a little bit further, you realize it doesn't rise to the level, which is basically that the person is not able to appreciate the ramifications of their actions at the time they take these acts. And actually, literally, that's a result of their severe mental disease or defect. You also relate many times to people who are mentally retarded, who are not able to ever understand the ramifications of their acts, and therefore they're not, in our system, competent. And sometimes there's a distinction made there between whether they're competent and whether they be not guilty by reason of insanity. But a lot of times, as a defense lawyer, we're looking at sort of both in conjunction right from the very beginning.
How difficult is it to, if you believe your client is incompetent to stand trial, how difficult is it to get him labeled such?
Well, you would put the prosecutor in the court on notice that you have some competency issues. In fact, the competency issue, whether or not somebody is able to understand the proceedings against them, and also whether or not they can help in their own defense. And I think it's a statement in terms of how important that is. It relates back to due process, whether people can get a fair trial and be a part of this system. Judges, prosecutors, and defense lawyers are allowed to bring someone's competency, a defendant's competency, to the court's attention. So the court, even on their own motion, can raise this issue if they're having concerns that this person isn't, able to help themselves and isn't able to understand the proceedings against them. Typically, it's done ahead of trial. If a defense lawyer such as myself raises it to a court ahead of trial, the court's required to look further into it and ask for an evaluation to be done. Oftentimes, it's hard to say ahead of time. And so if the trial starts, and you've heard of stories in the news where defendants are kicking their own lawyers and things like this, many times the judge can exercise his or her discretion to have that person evaluated right then during the trial.
How often in your practice, in your defense practice, have you sought for incompetency?
It's rare.
Even incompetent to stand trial is rare.
Correct.
Okay.
And not guilty by reason of insanity, I think, is even more rare. Many times the competency issue is one that you look into, and looking out for your client's best interest, of course, and try to determine whether or not they really can help you defend them and whether or not they understand the proceedings that are pending against them. More often than not, our experience has been with mentally handicapped people or mentally retarded people, where it's pretty clear coming in, parents are involved and mental health professionals right from the very beginning. This person may have made a mistake, but he or she didn't understand what they were doing and the seriousness of that anyways. And so competency is much more frequent. It still is less frequent than even, I guess maybe the other way to look at it is mental health issues and treatment, sort of like drug addiction and others, a lot of times is almost more of a mitigating factor as you deal with the overall case. And so when you're talking to the judge and the prosecutor trying to say, hey, this young person has been, treating for bipolar disease, maybe they're off their medicine regimen and really this isn't them. Let us show you that. But it doesn't even go to the level of competency. Remember, competency means that they're not capable of assisting in their own defense and also not able to understand the objective of the proceedings.
John, how have things changed over the years as our understanding of mental illness has evolved? What do you think? I mean, we understand more about mental illness and what causes it, and there seems to be more empathy for people who are mentally ill, but the laws...
I'm afraid I'm going to have to defer to the medical folks on that question. I really don't know the answer to that.
How do you think Ohio ranks in how it treats cases of incompetency and not guilty by reason of insanity?
Personally, I think our statutes in this state are good, pretty much state of the art. There are some states who have adopted something called guilty but mentally ill, which could apply to an awful lot of criminal defendants. There are a lot of criminal defendants who are mentally ill in one way or another, but they never reach the level of insanity under our definition,
right.
But they could reach the level of mentally ill under the other states' definitions. In Ohio, you know, this is from the prosecutor's perspective, of course, but in Ohio, those people are convicted. They're not found guilty but mentally ill and sent off to a mental institution. They're convicted and sent to prison. Now, they should, if they need it, get treatment in prison, and that's a whole other issue, whether there are sufficient resources that these folks ought to have if they're convicted. But those folks are convicted. They should not be found. I don't like the idea of guilty but mentally ill. I think it sweeps in a lot of people who don't belong in that category and should be simply convicted.
Okay. We're going to have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll have James Tyak, criminal defense attorney, with us. John Murphy will hang around for a while, and we'll also welcome Judge Daniel Hogan of the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas. We'll take some calls, and if you have some emails, you can go to allsides@wosu.org to send those, and you can call us at 614-292-8513, and also post your questions or comments on All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is Ann Fisher, and All Sides with Ann Fisher is now on the new 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. Every day, All Sides discusses the issues you are talking about, and now we want you to join the conversation on 89.7 FM. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 a.m. to noon every day on the new 89.7 NPR News and streaming at wosu.org/allsides.
And thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today on 89.7 NPR News. It's 24 degrees in downtown Columbus with some light snow. A winter weather advisory is in effect until midnight tonight. Expect 1 to 3 inches of snow throughout the day, a high of 28 degrees. A little more snow tonight, another inch or two possible, a low of 21. And then another half inch of snow expected Wednesday morning and a high of 25, looking ahead to Wednesday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guests, James Tyak, criminal defense attorney. James, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And also John Murphy's with us. He's executive director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. John, I'm glad you could be with us again.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Judge Daniel Hogan. He's a Franklin County Court of Common Pleas. Judge, welcome to the show, Judge.
Thanks for having me here.
We've been talking about this is one of those issues that arises periodically when something horrible happens, and everybody wonders, how could this happen? Is this the sort of thing you think about, Judge, when you're adjudicating these kinds of cases, is what's the worst possible scenario if they do go to prison, or if they don't go to prison, or if they aren't treated properly?
Those thoughts always occur to you. But as a judge, what you do is you follow the law. You are educated by the prosecution and by the defense. You learn the facts of the particular case. You rely upon what the mental health professionals tell you about the particular person. You judge all of that, and then you follow the law.
James, when you're making a decision, when you're representing somebody, how do you come to the conclusion either there's a competency issue or not guilty by reason of insanity? How does that process work for you as a defense lawyer?
Yeah, many times the issue is brought to our attention by our own client or perhaps their family and sometimes other professionals if the person's, for example, in the custody of the state for mental health reasons already. Then what we do and really what we're forced to do, having not the expertise that the medical experts do in mental health and medical training, is rely on psychiatrists, psychologists to help us evaluate whether or not this person can really understand the proceedings against them. Certainly, the expert testimony would be involved in cases where not guilty by reason of insanity is involved. And so we ultimately, as lawyers, have to rely on the expert witnesses. In this instance, it's medical professionals.
Are you confident that your clients who are mentally ill are getting the treatment they need to return to society? Is that ever your concern?
I've not had that concern. Typically, there's a lot of work done with the medical professionals, with the family of our clients, to make certain there is a nice, well thought out and a good plan for them to be successful. Typically, in my experience, we're not dealing with somebody that's incredibly dangerous, so we're talking about really rehabilitation and treatment rather than, you know, pure punishment for example, this gentleman out in Arizona. But I think that for the most part, I feel as though it does, work ultimately, in that when you have a plan, a lot of times I think it's more of a mitigating factor as well. Judges are required and always do anyways listen to mitigating factors in terms of what we're going to do with the person that's before the court. And many times the prosecutor's office will agree when there's a well-defined mental health problem, it's really in everyone's best interest to have them treated.
Judge, there's a inmate that's a regular at the Franklin County Jail. They call him the frequent flyer, I think, because he's been there so many times, like 230 times in the last 10 years. This is a big problem with people who are mentally ill. They keep going around and around and around. It's a vicious cycle. Are you satisfied with how the system works now to treat people when they are adjudicated, when they are imprisoned? They're being punished, but are they also being helped properly?
I'm convinced that all is well. I think our system works well. You can always find anecdotal evidence to prove the contrary, but generally speaking, I'm confident that the system that we have set up deals with the problem. Now, with that said, we live in a free society, and you're always going to have situations like the one over in Clark County, like what occurred this past weekend in Tucson. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I believe, as John Murphy said, that our statutes take care of the problems.
The issue in Tucson with the shooter who killed six people and wounded the congresswoman, as far as I can see at this point, that's an issue of point of contact and the question of whether the campus police, who had been called five times, that's sort of another issue, that first contact that law enforcement has with somebody and how they handle it from then on. It's not until, you know, he has a lawyer now, but everything's changed now. But before that, how could you have known?
My understanding, and all I know is what I read, is up till now he has had no contact with the criminal justice system.
Right.
So there's no way that the system could have intervened.
Right. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. And Tom from Marion, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I wonder if your guests can give us some idea how these cases break down by gender or by age groups.
Are there enough to draw any conclusions?
I cannot, as a judge, draw that conclusion, and I don't have that data. You have a mental health professional coming on later in the show, and perhaps they could address that question. When I say all is well, let me say this. There is a tiny, tiny number of cases that come before the court where not guilty by reason of insanity is the issue. Male, female, I don't know the numbers, but the number is so tiny it's almost not worth discussing. When bad things happen, of course, everybody becomes concerned. But as far as the numbers of cases that I see in 14 years on the bench, I have not had a contested sanity issue for me or for a jury. There is a larger number of people who present as not competent to stand trial, that they can't understand the proceeding, they can't help their lawyer, and the system is set up to deal with them. The largest group of people that we see are people who deal with mental health problems. It doesn't rise to competency, certainly isn't sanity, but it affects their behavior on a daily basis. Those present the largest problem to the criminal justice system.
Thanks, Tom, for your call.
Thank you.
So what do you learn when the numbers are so small? What have you learned over the years about what you look for when you do have a contested competency proceeding or not guilty by reason of insanity?
Well, I was an assistant prosecutor for 18 years, mm-hmm. and when I wore that hat, what I looked for the very few times that I dealt with it would be some expert mental health professional. The person is evaluated, and then you deal with what the mental health professional suggests in their opinion. As a judge, I rely upon both the defense, the prosecution, and the experts that they bring forth and make those determinations.
Do you, because it's more difficult now, they've raised the bar, it's become more and more difficult over the years, as John mentioned earlier, is there any concern, and I guess, James, you know, you could talk about this too, that people don't, that lawyers don't bring up the competency issue or guilty by reason of insanity because it's not going to be worth it, that it's going to be too much of a struggle?
Well,
James?
Thank you. In terms of when they're contested, they are exceptional. In fact, many times they're in the news. The sniper case here in Columbus was a contested not guilty.
2005?
Mr. McCoy. Not guilty by reason of insanity, which you may remember ended in a mistrial. And my understanding is that the jury was not able to decide whether or not they believed he was not guilty by reason of insanity. That case worked itself out with a plea bargain later, probably in no small part because of the sanity issue. That's a very rare, you know, circumstance. The other one that comes to mind, again, you get into a battle of experts in some ways of these medical professionals was the – I believe her name was Yates, the woman in Texas.
Andrea Yates.
Who drowned her five children. That case was – she was found guilty initially with the jury deciding she was not guilty by reason of insanity because the expert for the prosecution had lied under oath. And it came back, and then the jury the second time found her not guilty by reason of insanity, and she was committed to an institution there in Texas. So I think that those are the very rare circumstances when you have those contested issues. And ultimately, although the lawyers are doing their job, it's the medical professionals who are really able to give the conclusions of whether or not this person understands the proceedings against them in terms of competency or whether or not they're able to appreciate the wrongfulness of their acts in terms of sanity.
614-292-8513, if you'd like to join the conversation. Karen from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thank you so much for doing a show on such an important issue. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And I also appreciate having the ears of your guest today. I noticed that it was brought up that a person has to demonstrate that they are willing to hurt or a possibility of hurting others or hurting themselves. And this is an issue that I faced in dealing with my father back in around 1987 or so. So I was kind of surprised to hear that point brought up because the position that we were in at the time was that he was clearly out of his mind. My father's a huge man, 6'4", and over 200 pounds, and has had instances of like 27 police officers having to get a hold of him to take him in and things like that. So this was a big concern for me then, him hurting someone. And so we had a psychologist, court psychologist, come and see him who he did not display those tendencies to. But we in the family, we know that he has those tendencies. He's done things before. And so basically we were put in a position of having to go visit him to convince him to display those tendencies, which was an extremely dangerous notion.
Well, that's a good question, Karen. I mean, James and Judge Hogan, how much do you look to the family to make these kinds of decisions?
Well,
the mental health professionals rely to a great degree upon the family, and both the defense and the prosecution are free to present evidence that they feel is appropriate, and evidence from the family can be presented.
Mm-hmm. So it's a okay, Kieran. Thanks for your call. Take care. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What's your goal, Judge Hogan, when a defendant is mentally ill, potentially dangerous, possibly incompetent? What are your options as a judge when a person like that comes into your court and maybe no one has asked for an incompetency ruling, or they're not seeking not guilty by reason of insanity?
Well, let's talk about competency, because that's what comes up. As I said before, the sanity issue hardly ever comes up. Mm-hmm. The law allows the judge on his or her own to order a competency evaluation, even if the defense lawyer and the prosecution have not raised the issue. That's happened to me a couple times in 14 years, where I can see behavior in the courtroom or I hear of behavior outside of the courtroom that makes me think that the evaluation is necessary. So the law allows for that.
Do the special docket, the mental health courts, help, do you think, deal with a lot of these cases more efficiently?
As I indicated before, there's three levels, and at that lowest level,
right,
where people have mental illness that affects their behavior on a day-to-day basis, I believe that the mental health courts are very effective.
But in the long run, over time, if you can start dealing with them at that level, then they don't – perhaps it doesn't ratchet up to something more serious later on.
That's certainly the hope.
Is that – okay. 614-292-8513. We had a caller. They wanted to know if we should look at social media to look for cases like that of the Arizona shooter. I don't know if that kind of issue where people are trying to speculate on what I would imagine it's very difficult to speculate at this point what caused the problem.
I think that would be pure speculation.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with anything social media related to that case.
Well, it's sort of viral.
Yeah.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. James, how do you think the system in Ohio works and ranks in your opinion?
Well, I wanted to comment actually on whether the mental health courts are helping. Mm-hmm. I think they really are, and I think what they do, along with in sort of emphasizing treatment and rehabilitation for people that have mental health issues, is literally making people in the system appreciate that it's okay to recognize and say ultimately to public officials, I have a mental health problem. And I think what the goal of some of these courts, certainly the ones I'm more exposed to here in Franklin County, is to keep them from becoming those frequent flyer type people that you mentioned earlier, going into the Franklin County jail hundreds and hundreds of times. Many times, I think those people really benefit from the weekly meetings, because the professionals that are involved in those courts sometimes can tell by spotting visually whether or not the person's taking their medication, for example. Mm-hmm. And so my experience with it is that they are so far very successful. My personal experience with clients in the mental health courts here in town has also been very successful for my clients.
Do you think that there's any room for improvements in how the law works in Ohio?
In terms of how the law works, I'm not sure that there's any obvious part that there's improvements. I think when a case like the Clark County case comes to our attention, it's because something's gone wrong. I'm sure that the release of the gentleman there and the history of that case is well known to those lawyers and judges involved in it, and I have no doubt that they did absolutely everything they could to make the right decisions. So in terms of the actual structure and the statutory makeup that John has talked about as well, it seems to be built in a way that really allows the defendants the access to help they need, and it allows the court and the prosecution the opportunity to do what they need. Remember, this is an adversarial system, and so I think what we've all agreed upon here, though, is that the truly contested not guilty by reason of insanity or the truly contested competency issue is just exceptionally rare.
614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, and Julia from Cleveland, you're on the air. You want to talk about people who might be pressing charges having problems. What's your question?
My question is what if the person that's making the complaint has a mental issue, something that you can consider, like we think she has Munchausen's?
Okay.
And nobody wants to look into that to see if there's any possibility that we can clear the person that's being charged.
John, from a prosecutor's point of view, what are your options at that point when you think that there's something wrong with the person pressing charges?
Well, the prosecutor always has to evaluate the credibility of the person who's coming to them with claims or charges. And if, you know, if you're not convinced that the person is telling the truth or is living in a dream world or is detached from reality in one way or another, you're not going to file charges based on what they're saying without some pretty substantial supporting evidence, corroborating evidence from other sources. However, as far as our discussion today is concerned, we're talking about people charged with crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about somebody who's just making a complaint, that person is not charged with a crime. You'd have to talk to the civil lawyers, I think, about that issue. There is the probate court. Persons can be referred to the probate court for evaluation as to whether or not they need mental help or, in extreme cases, whether they should be committed. But that's a little out of my bailiwick. It's
well,
a civil issue.
If I may, and she, Julia mentions Munchausen. You could do a couple of shows on that disease alone.
Right.
And so I think that what John's saying with the prosecutorial discretion, you know, ultimately a lot of times that's just having an open line of communication to make sure that if the defense counsel or a defendant, you know, wants to bring those issues to the prosecutor's attention, even ahead of the courts, they can do that. My experience has been that prosecutors, at least in Columbus and Central Ohio, are very open to those phone calls and look closely at the people bringing those charges. Typically, with Munchausen's involved, they're very serious charges.
Judge?
If someone believes they're being accused and the person doing the accusing is mentally ill, then they need to bring that to the attention of the law enforcement authorities. And if the person has been charged, they will have a lawyer, and they need to bring that to the attention of the lawyer.
Okay. Julia, thanks for your call. We have to take another break. I want to thank our guest at this point, John Murphy of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also James Tyak, criminal defense attorney. James, glad you could be here today.
My pleasure.
And Judge Daniel Hogan of the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas. Judge, I'm glad you could be in the studio today.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Adam H. Board of Franklin County's medical director, Dr. Kathy Burns. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on WOSU 89.7 NPR News.
Listen to local news from the award-winning WOSU News team and national news from NPR on the new 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to enjoy the best in classical music on the new Classical 101. Classical music all day, every day. It's all news on 89.7 NPR News and all classical on Classical 101. For more information and to stream our services online, visit WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins. Last week, a video of Ted Williams, a homeless man with a golden radio voice, went viral on the Internet, bringing him fame and employment. Today on All Sides, we'll talk about the impact of social media on the news media and popular culture. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11 on All Sides with Ann Fisher. And it's currently 24 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is some light snow. A winter weather advisory is in effect until midnight tonight. There'll be snow and areas of blowing snow with an accumulation of 1 to 3 inches likely and a high of 28 degrees today. Snow showers continue tonight, a new accumulation tonight of 1 to 2 inches and a low of 21 degrees. And then another half inch of snow for Wednesday morning, then cloudy in the afternoon and a high of 25. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. The state of Ohio has cut funding to mental health programs by 35% in the past 3 years. as the state faces an estimated $8 billion budget shortfall in the coming biennium. More cuts are possible. Joining us now to talk about that and more as it relates to the criminal justice system is Kathy Burns, medical director of the Alcohol, Drugs, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County. Her clinical and administrative work both have been done entirely in the public sector, including stints as medical director in the Ohio prison system. She is recognized as an expert in the delivery of mental health care in jails and prisons. Welcome to the show, Kathy.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. How does the treatment differ, you know, getting right at the issue of the incompetency and or not guilty by reason of insanity? What happens to people in those cases?
Well, if the issue of incompetency is raised, as you've covered with your other guests, a person is evaluated by a mental health professional. The court would find them incompetent, and then generally they're sent to a hospital for a period of treatment and also training about the legal system.
The fellow in Clark County who shot the sheriff's deputy, I know you're not going to comment on that case per se, but the question arose is, was he getting enough oversight? So I'm asking you, are you confident that there's enough oversight in the system for people who are released under these conditions?
Well, in fact, people who are found not guilty by reason of insanity really end up spending more time in a state hospital than they would have spent had they been found guilty of an offense and sent to prison. And then after their release, they continue to be followed in the community with conditions on their release, like being compliant with taking prescribed medications and following up with doctor's appointments and counseling and case management appointments. And if they don't comply with those things, then they're returned to the hospital.
Can we talk a little bit about the not guilty by reason of insanity? What for you, what constitutes that threshold? How do we describe somebody like that? What's different? You know, what do we mean by understanding? There's the competency thing, understanding what you've done is wrong, or no, competency has more to do with helping your lawyer with the trial, understanding what's ahead. The not guilty by reason of insanity has to do with, did you know what you were doing? Did you understand?
Right. Competency really looks at the person's mental state as they're going to trial,
right,
or what they look like now. Sanity, or not guilty by reason of insanity, really kind of looks back in time as to what their mental disease was like at the time of the commission of the alleged offense, and then whether or not they knew it was wrong.
Now, John Murphy of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association said that he considers Ohio's laws in that regard, both in the competency issue and on the not guilty by reason of insanity, to be state of the art. Wouldn't change a thing, really, at this point. Are you satisfied?
Yes. You know, when I look across the country at how competency restoration services are provided to people who have serious mental illnesses, many places do not admit people to hospitals. They try and provide those services in jails, which are already overtaxed with taking care of all of the people that they have to take care of. So that Ohio sends people to a state hospital, that they receive very good care with there. All of our state hospitals are accredited by the Joint Commission, and that we have kind of a low threshold so that if there's even a shadow of a doubt about someone's competence, they can be referred for treatment, I think are all very, very positive things.
Go ahead.
And similarly, if someone is found not guilty by reason of insanity, and I do want to stress at how very, very rare that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think studies have shown that it's raised as a potential defense less than 1% of the time in all criminal prosecutions. And it prevails only about 1% of those times. So it really is quite rare. In Franklin County, for example, we have only about 50 people right now who have been, that have been found not guilty by reason of insanity. So out of all of the criminal prosecutions, to have a grand total of 50 people is really a demonstration of how quite rare it is to be found not guilty by reason of insanity.
We had a caller earlier who asked about breakdowns in gender and age. Is there even enough, are there enough numbers to have any statistical conclusions in that way?
Well, I know from my personal experience of having treated people both in the state hospital and in the community who've been found not guilty by reason of insanity, men outnumber women. by a factor of at least 3 or 4 to 1, which is not unusual given that that's the same sort of statistic in terms of general offenses. Men outnumber women. There are more men in prison than there are women in prison, for example. More men are arrested than women are arrested for criminal behaviors. And they tend to be a little bit, they're sort of in their late 20s, 30s, and 40s if they're found not guilty by reason of insanity. They tend to be a little bit older than the average patient entering the hospital system.
Lots of times, particularly when it comes to an ailment such as schizophrenia, the patient, it's the onset is in the early 20s. And we've had lots of cases now where their first point of contact with law enforcement is often in high schools or colleges.
Right.
Do you think there's a need for more training when it comes to those points of contact for police officers, or are they already being trained, and are you satisfied that it's just a matter of you can't catch them all?
Well, many people, police officers are being trained. In Ohio, we have refresher courses for law enforcement officers to get additional training on an annual basis with respect to recognizing potential signs and symptoms of mental illness. And in Franklin County and in many, many other counties across the state, we offer a week-long training called Crisis Intervention Team Training for law enforcement and first responders 2 or 3 times a year. And so people are brought into the classroom. They have a week-long training on how to intervene, how to recognize signs and symptoms of illness, and how to intervene and hopefully diffuse situations, and also kind of divert people back into the mental health treatment system, if possible, you know, depending on what the nature of the call is that they're being sent out for, but being diverted from jails and prisons back into treatment, if at all possible.
The Ohio Department of Mental Health, in partnership with the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, developed the Community Linkage Program in 1995, and it was to provide continuity of care for mentally ill offenders entering and leaving ODRC correctional facilities. Is this still in place? Do you know if that's still operating, and does that sort of effort help?
It certainly has helped, and yes, it still is in place. It, like most many, many other state and county programs, has suffered some budgetary cutbacks, as we all have, given the economic times. But generally, the staff people from the Department of Mental Health would hook up with the Department of Corrections to find out who's receiving mental health services in the prison, who's set to leave, and then get with the prisoner, find out where they're going, and send information ahead of time, which is really key to the community that the person is going to be reentering, so that services can be set up. The person leaves with a small supply of medications, and so if we learn ahead of time that they're coming back, we can make sure that their next follow-up appointment is before those medicines run out, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a lot of work with respect to being sure that people could reapply for Supplemental Security Income, SSI, and Medicaid before they even leave the prison system so that there are no gaps in services. So the program's still working. I don't work for them.
Mm-hmm.
I get referrals from them at Adam H. in Franklin County, and I would say more would be better because we have a very large number of people in prison who will be coming home, and the sooner we can get information about them, the more likely we are to be able to make sure that there's nobody falls through the cracks.
I was wondering, jails tend to be shorter stays, and I was wondering how do jails and state prisons differ in their approach to treatment during incarceration?
Prisons, because people do stay longer, generally do have to develop a much more comprehensive care system so that there's crisis care, there's the ability to do suicide prevention, there's ongoing care, there's counseling, there's group treatment, individual treatment, and even the capacity to provide inpatient or residential care. in jails, people do stay shorter, and so there's provisions for all of those things, but oftentimes they're in the community. For example, in Franklin County, if someone needs to be psychiatrically hospitalized, rather than keeping them at the jail, they're transferred to Twin Valley, the state psychiatric hospital, as a jail transfer so that they get their care there rather than having the jail have to recreate that type of care.
Are there enough beds, though? Are there enough places to put people, whether it's in, hospitals or in the community? Is there enough?
Well, we've experienced a shortage of inpatient psychiatric care beds in Franklin County between both the state system as well as the private system. As you're probably aware, it's been in the news for the past couple of years that people are having to wait extraordinarily long times in places like emergency rooms in order to be admitted to the hospital. So we do need more inpatient care, and we do need more outpatient care. When the decision was made in the late 60s and early 70s that care would be better provided in the community, it was a grand idea, but the funding didn't follow the grand idea in order to be able to provide the kind of comprehensive wraparound services that are necessary.
What are your concerns looking forward with the budget? As I said at the outset of this segment, there's already been 35% cuts over the last 3 years, and that's on top of cuts, really.
Right.
Or lack of increases over the last almost 20 years.
Right. We've really been concerned that, you know, we've had to pass along budget cuts to our service providers in the community at the community mental health centers. We've tried to hold Net Care Access Crisis Center harmless from these budget cuts so that they could continue to address the crisis needs of all the people in Franklin County. The problem has been that after that immediate crisis is resolved or assessed, there is still a long waiting list for services for ongoing care. So that's our concern, is that, first of all, there's a shortage of hospital beds. People can't get in as quickly as they ought to, given the severity of the distress, and that services in the community are shrinking so that wait lists are longer, and even the types of care that people used to receive has had to be reduced somewhat.
Now, people might say, by the way, I just want to remind folks, my guest is Dr. Kathy Burns. She's the medical director for Adam H. in Franklin County. People might say, you know what, that's not my problem. I don't know anybody who's mentally ill like this. We have private insurance. We don't have to worry about it. We can always find a place, you know, to put if something were to happen. Is this something that the people generally should be concerned about, or is it really pretty much the only people that need to worry about are the people who are mentally ill and their families?
Well, no, I think everybody needs to worry about it. First of all, we know that one in five people has some form of mental illness. So obviously they're on a continuum, just like diabetes. Some people can manage it with diet and exercise, diabetes that is, and other people need an oral pill, and other people need to do insulin pumps. Mental illnesses are like that as well. There are times when symptoms are milder and times when symptoms are more severe. And even within a given disorder, there's a range of the distress and the dysfunction that people can have as a consequence of their illness. So about one in five, that means we all know somebody with a mental illness and probably are related to somebody potentially with some sort of mental health issue or problem. So it is a concern for all of us. And, you know, as resources dry up, even people with insurance, if there's no hospital bed, there's no hospital bed. And of course, having insurance, you know, is better than not. But there are diminishing resources available even for people who are able to afford it through private health insurance policies.
David from Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. We just have a few minutes left.
Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
Some 20 years ago, when I worked for the big psychiatric hospital in Columbus, I developed the training component for the Restoration of Competency program. And Dr. Burns has been very informative about how things have been. People who come to that setting in a hospital to be restored, there's the psychiatric treatment component to diminish the symptoms. But the other part is training the person concerning the legal system. And some interesting, many interesting experiences I had. But many times, both the patient and their defense attorney really don't wish them to be restored to competency because they felt that the treatment provided in a psychiatric hospital would be much better than anything they would get if found competent, guilty, and sent to a high reformatory or penitentiary. So you had this problem of the person maybe not wanting to be compliant with the medical treatment, and also after a prolonged period of experiencing symptoms of illness, they really did have to learn about the legal system and how their future would be if they went to trial. People don't always know that. I mean, not everyone knows what it's like to be accused and how you assist your attorney and possible consequences of being found guilty. So it's very complex when you get into the field and you're actually working with the individual who's ill and accused of a serious crime.
Okay. Thank you, David.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Burns?
Well, it's very true that there are two components, as David suggested. First of all, to treat the mental illness so that the symptoms are not interfering with the person's ability to participate in their own defense and to tend to the events of a trial or to even understand that the seriousness of what they've been charged with. And then the other big component, as he said, was to really do some of the education about the legal system and being able to communicate when they're in good shape psychiatrically with their attorney to really do some strategy and planning around their trial.
Well, Dr. Kathy Burns, medical director of the Adam H. in Franklin County, I guess this is kind of an ongoing conversation we're having, isn't it?
Yes.
Never ending. Thanks for joining me again today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for asking.
That's all the time we have for All Sides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.